everybody. I can see we have not a single Washington Nationals fan in the audience. Their second games tonight, undefeated. Gio Gonzalez is pitching. It's been a big day in D.C. The Wizards won last night, the Caps won, and Congress is out of session. It doesn't get any better than this. Welcome to the American Security Project. I'm Steve Chaney, the CEO. And we're a unique organization, bipartisan. We take on topical issues from a national security perspective. We've got an equal number of Republicans and Democrats. Among our founders were some familiar names, Kerry, Hagel, Hart, Rudman, Christine Todd Whitman, among others. And then we add in about six or seven flag officers and businessmen. Most recently, one of our famous members, General Lester Lyles, has just been named chairman of USAA. So we're excited about that. Nelson Cunningham is now president of McLarty Associates. So we're pretty excited about what's going on with us, and of course with now secretaries Kerry and Hagel. Unfortunately, had to depart the board, but they fully support what we're doing. So it's been an interesting time for ASP. We are an educational organization. We are not a lobbying organization, but we take on a number of issues. And one of our plank issues from our beginning has been climate change. Among others that we had were nuclear security, energy security, American competitiveness, asymmetric operations, terrorism. Climate change has been one of our plank issues from the get-go, and the national security implications of climate change, and that's why we're here this evening. What I am proposed to do is I'm going to introduce our senior fellow for climate, Andrew Holland, let him talk for a couple of minutes, and then I'll do an introduction of General Munir Razaman from Bangladesh, and he'll make a quick statement. And I think we'll do just kind of an informal give and take up the table, and then we'll have you all participate, which will be a lot less formal than the way we normally do it. I think we have a small enough group we can get a good dialogue going. So with that, I talk about climate change and its national security implications. I think I'll introduce Andrew, who has just returned from Seoul, Korea, from a major conference that General Munir Razaman helped chair. And Andrew, why don't you talk about that and what's going on in climate change for ASP?
Great, thanks very much, Steve. I'll start by talking about the conference in Seoul, which was a very strong statement that climate change does threaten security by the countries involved. It was focused on East Asia and the Asia Pacific, which given the amount of tension and everything on the Korean Peninsula right now, you'd be surprised that, you know, such a non-traditional issue as climate change would be thought of as a security threat. But it clearly is. The South Korean government very clearly states that climate change is a threat to security and has planned in their military planning documents for it. It's great to see that. It was an important statement from the conference that does threaten security. ASP's done a lot on climate change and security in the last year. In November, we released our climate security report, fairly lengthy analysis of how climate change threatens security both here in the United States and around the world. One of the areas we talk about is South Asia in the report, and Bangladesh occupies a fairly prominent place in that. It's ranked as one of the world's most vulnerable countries to climate change. We mentioned that 80% of the landmass of Bangladesh consists of delta and complex floodplains. Only a 45-centimeter sea level rise would result in the loss of almost 11% of Bangladesh's territory, where over 5.5 million people live. So this is not an academic exercise. This is questions of people's livelihoods and questions of national security. I know Munir knows these statistics better than I do, so I'm not going to dwell on it for too long. The only other thing I would mention is that we've recently put out a new index, a Global Security Defense Index on climate change, that seeks to look at every country in the world, 196 countries, and determine whether they see climate change as a threat to their national security. We started this thinking about the U.S. NPR saying climate change is a threat multiplier, and wanted to see what other countries have done. And it turns out, of the countries that we've analyzed, over 70% of them have a statement in either a written military document, defense planning document, such as defense white papers or the like, or a statement by a senior government official, prime minister, ambassadors to the UN, or the like, that climate change threatens their security. So a resounding statement from around the world that this is an important issue and it needs action. There were no countries, zero countries, that questioned the science of climate change. Very interesting. With that, I'm happy to talk more, but I'll turn it over to Munir, back to Steve.
Yeah, Andrew, let me just do, we can talk about that here a little bit later, because I think there's some points in our index that really ought to be raised in terms of countries' attitudes towards climate change and national security. But our guest of honor this evening is Major General Munir Razaman. He's a career military officer from Bangladesh, served 38 years in active duty. I'm proud to say that he is a fellow artilleryman. And for those not familiar, artillery is what lends dignity to what would otherwise be a vulgar brawl. And he and I clearly understand this. We had a great conversation earlier this evening, and I've got about two pages about the units that you served with and all the times you've had in combat, but I won't embarrass you by reading all that. But I will say he served with the United Nations peacekeeping missions throughout the world. He is currently president and CEO of the Bangladesh Institute of Peace and Security Studies, which is a think tank based in Dhaka. He's chairman of the Global Military Advisory Council on Climate Change, which is an international coalition of generals and admirals, of which I am a member. And he advises governments about national security threats on climate change. Most recently, as Andrew mentioned, he spoke on behalf of what we call the GMAC at the International Conference on Climate Security in the Asia-Pacific region in Seoul, Korea, and Andrew was there as well. With that, I'll turn the floor over to you, General.
Thank you, Steve. Let me say that it's a great pleasure for me to be here this evening, talking to you on an issue which is of critical importance not only for Bangladesh, but for the rest of the world. Climate change is now considered a national security threat to many countries in the world, and interestingly, it has deep security implications for your country, United States. Climate change is also considered by the United Nations in its July resolution as an international security issue. So it's not only a threat multiplier anymore, as per the CNS report, but it is now considered a threat that not only touches on regional national security, but it has deep international security implications. As the chairman just mentioned, let me begin by also talking about GMAC for a while. The Global Military Advisory Council on Climate Change is a coalition of serving generals and admirals from various countries touching all continents, and we work extensively on the security implications of climate change and has been engaging with governments in many places and extensively with international bodies and organizations like the NATO, like the ASEAN Regional Forum, like European Union. And we also made the first international call, drawing attention of the international community and governments in the Conference of Parties on COP15 in Copenhagen. That is the first time a formal call was given to the international community, drawing the attention to the grave consequences of climate change to national and international security. It is quite well understood today that the impacts of climate change are no longer confined to small communities and states, but they have serious consequences, particularly touching on the nexus between food, water, and energy. This is the nexus that touches many countries and many societies that graduates to the level of security and has deep security implications, not only for the state, but also for nations and regions. It is also important to say that many countries which are faced with the challenge of climate change also happen to be countries which are fragile in nature. Countries in sub-Saharan Africa, countries in the Middle East, countries in South America, or in my region, South Asia. Many countries which are fragile in nature, weak in capacity, also have grave challenges from the threat of climate change, and the state's capacity to deal with them is so limited that at times they will be overwhelmed by the pressure and the threat that comes from climate change. Let me give you the example of Bangladesh here so that you understand slightly more in practical terms. Because when you talk about climate change in international conferences, we talk theories. But when you talk of Bangladesh, we talk of practicalities on the ground. Because to Bangladesh, climate change is not a theory, but it's something that is already happening on the ground. The country is one of the most densely populated in the world. A country of the size of 55,000 square miles has a population of 170 million people. So you can imagine the pressure and the density of the population. It is now faced with a loss of land, potential loss of land due to sea level rise. The coastal region of the country is already experiencing some impacts of sea level rise. And when the sea level rise, as per the IPCC's fourth assessment report, happens by 2050, the country will lose 17 to 20% of its land mass, which will generate a climate refugee population of 30 to 35 million people. Whenever I say the numbers, people check back with me, have I got the numbers right? But that is the correct number. So when you have 30 to 35 million people uprooted, are on the move, then it is certainly a national security issue. And because these 30 to 35 million people will not be absorbed within the capacity of the state because of lack of space and capacity, they will go for transboundary migration of a nature that the world has never experienced before. And the only direction they can go is towards India, because India borders Bangladesh on three sides. Why I mentioned this as a regional security issue is because many of you will not know that the Bangladesh-India border is completely fenced. As the walls between Berlin, East and West Berlin came down, and as we try and work on the concept of soft borders, the border between our two countries has been completely fenced unilaterally by India. They are in the process of electrifying the fence, and the Indian border guards regularly kill innocent Bangladeshi civilians, anybody who approaches the fence. So if that is a case of an attitude of security management at the border, imagine when masses of climate refugees try to migrate to that country or are forced to migrate, it will certainly end up into not only a human catastrophe, it will end up into tension and violence at the border. We have serious problems not only in Bangladesh but in the rest of the region of Asia and in many other parts on the issue of water. Water is becoming perhaps the most critical resource scarce element that we will be experiencing in the coming years and decades. And even if we don't have conflicts over other resources, we predict that there could be not only tensions but there could be also conflicts, both on a local basis, on an intrastate basis, or on interstate basis. Because the nature of the gravity of the shortage of water, which is happening on a natural basis and has been aggravated by climate-induced conditions, is becoming extremely dire. Similarly, when water is short, we will be experiencing food shortages, and food security is becoming a major issue in many parts of the world. And all of you will appreciate with me that water is the critical element in energy production. My friends here, Tracy and Chad, know this better than anybody else, that without water, we will be running short of energy. So we see the very dangerous nexus of the three resource critical sources of water, food, and energy, which all will be impacted by the grave consequences of climate change in the coming years. With those consequences of the climate change that are being experienced and will be aggravated in the coming years, I would only like to end here by saying that climate will and has become a national and an international security issue that can destabilize countries, regions, and will have very grave security consequences for the United States as it tries to stabilize, destabilize areas of the world. What do you think, General?
You know, I'm so glad you're here on a variety of reasons, not the least of which there are many in the United States who just don't believe in climate change and don't think it's a national security issue. And then when you look at Bangladesh and you see what dire consequences there are to your national security due to climate change, I would hope that many would believe that indeed it's a threat. And from that perspective, of course, I'm very glad that you're here and able to lay out these staggering statistics that you talk about in Bangladesh, in immigration, the threat, the trouble with India. Here we have a nuclear-armed India, by the way, not that that would escalate to that point, but then you talk about the Asia pivot that the Obama administration's talked about, and it, to me, maybe it lends a little more credibility to the thoughts about our pivot to Asia. We indeed have a base much closer to you in the Indian Ocean, and Diego Garcia, which is equally threatened by the rise in the sea. And if it rises as much as you mentioned, we're going to lose that base. And it's fairly significant in the number of resources that we station on that base. So again, I'm encouraged that you're here to tell people. I'm discouraged by the facts and figures that you quote and the impact that it's going to have on security worldwide. I would ask you, what do you think here in the United States that we ought to be doing in terms of countering climate change and the impact that it has on your country?
Let me start with the word Diego Garcia, because back in 2007, Secretary Gates spoke in the Shangri-La Dialogue, and he said that United States not only has interest in the Asia-Pacific, but United States is a resident Asian power. And when he said it's a resident Asian power, what he meant is that it has sovereign territory of Diego Garcia. But imagine part of your sovereignty will completely disappear. It'll go under the water. So when that happens, if that is not a security issue, what will be a security issue? Let me now bring you home to the Pacific Island states or the state of the Maldives. Many of these island states are in a position that we can lose them in next 10 to 15 or 20 years. These are countries or island states with small population, but here we are not talking about the demographic size. Here we are talking about states with sovereign rights. Here we are talking about people who have their own identities and nationalities, and that is about to disappear in that part of the world. It not only has security implications when a state disappears, but it has large consequences on the international legal regime, which we have not thought about, because we are still in a state of denial. Certainly in the United States and many of the places that where I go. I'll just give you one or two examples. When a state disappears from the face of the map, what happens to the maritime boundary, which we have worked out based on the UN clause? You shift the baseline of a maritime UNCLOS boundary and the rest of the relative boundaries change. But what happens when a complete state disappears? It will completely throw out the complete maritime boundary regime that we have based ourselves depending on the UNCLOS rules and regulations. What will happen to the sovereign identity of the people who are then forced to migrate to another place? What is going to happen to the water on which the countries once existed? Is that going to become international water? Or will that still remain the sovereign water of that state? So these are very critical and very complex, difficult international questions which we will need to address as soon as possible, because these are going to haunt us if we don't decide on them now. One of the biggest problems about climate change is the state of denial that we are in. For that reason, we know that there will be climate refugees of whatever number in the states. In the case of the island state, it's going to be 10, 20,000, 50,000. In the case of Bangladesh, it is going to be 30, 35 million people. But the category of climate refugees is not yet internationally recognized. We have accepted definitions of all other categories of refugees, but there is not an accepted definition of what constitutes a climate refugee. So we are here really running behind time. Unless we come to grip with some of the critical questions, however complex they are, we will be faced with a challenge when it happens right on our face, and we will not have the answers to deal with them. And that is not a situation that can maintain regional or international stability. It needs understanding not on a national basis, but it needs understanding at an international basis. The reason is, climate change is not a singular country problem. These have consequences, and the consequences are far-reaching. These are global problems, and they have to have global solutions. Let me again come back to the issue of water, because I see my good friend Swati sitting at the back who works on water. In the case of South Asia, water has become a case of serious security issue. First, starting with the water sharing between India and Pakistan, both nuclear powers. The Indus Treaty, which has been one of the successful treaties in the world, guaranteed by the World Bank, is now under stress, so much to the point that the treaty could collapse anytime, because India is building dams upstream. And the consequences of that damming of the rivers upstream is so serious for Pakistan that Pakistani security establishment has now began to identify water as a nuclear red line issue. Pakistan has got some nuclear red lines beyond which they will not allow any of the security situations to deteriorate, and they consider water sharing between the two countries as a nuclear security issue, and this has now been documented. So this is as serious as that. The relation between the hydrographic relation between China and India is under stress, because India alleges that China is going to build some dams in Upper Tibet area to dam Brahmaputra River. And when that happens, India is going to suffer tremendously, although China denies that it's going to build that. There are serious consequences of water sharing issues between Bangladesh and India. Bangladesh has got 54 transboundary rivers with India. We've only got a treaty on one single river, and that treaty is also not being honored on 53 other rivers. There is no sharing mechanism between the two countries. So as a lower riparian country, the country gets less and less share of its water, for which we either have more water in the monsoon when we don't want it and the Indians push it down on us, or during the lean period, we are completely dry and parts of the country is going through a process of desertification because we don't have sufficient water in the lean period. It is also important to mention here that Bangladesh is not only a country, it is the world's largest mega delta. And the very ecological balance of a mega delta depends on the cycles of water that it flows through its rivers and the systems. And those cycles have been completely destabilized. Therefore, if it continues for a much longer period, and if the conditions deteriorate because we are not getting the sufficient cycles of water at the right time, then the ecology of the mega delta will die. And when the ecology of the mega delta dies, it is a land that becomes uninhabitable. So the consequences that we see now are such that they have such far-reaching impacts that they cannot be taken as a mere impacts of climate change, but they have to be taken as a matter of national security, a matter of regional or international security.
Boy, that's all of that is frightening to say the least, not the least of which, when you talk about Pakistan, China, India, all also being nuclear powers. I mean, this is
staggering, actually. Andrew, anything you want to add to or ask the general?
Yeah, so I want to dive a little bit more into South Asia and India in particular. In our index on climate change, we found all of the countries of South Asia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Nepal, Sri Lanka, the Maldives, clearly state that climate change was a threat to their security, and some of them very strong in Maldives see it as an existential threat. Bangladesh has a very strong statement on it. All that except India. India does not see it as a threat to security. In fact, they specifically avoid calling it a security threat. Meanwhile, they are, you know, one of the most vulnerable countries to climate change. They do talk about that. They talk about it as an environmental issue, as an environmental danger. What do you think is behind Indian government's reluctance to engage on this issue? Do you see any facts on the ground that change this?
The reason that India does not see climate change as a security issue is because of the fear that the agenda could be driven by other countries. It has a fear that the moment it is seen as a security issue and they have an acceptance of this theory, that the issues could be decided in the Security Council and they have binding obligations as a member state. And that is a fear that India carries very deeply. India is also a country which is quite suspicious of any decisions which are on which they are not in total control. So they have a fear about the issue being turned as a security issue. At least on migration, for example, they have real concerns that if this is considered as a security issue and there are international obligations, then they might have international bindings and obligation to accept an X number of migrants getting into the country. So India continues to refuse to see climate as a security issue. But I see a change of heart in the Chinese, Andrew. Mm. The Chinese have of late become far more open to talking about this and accepting many of the issues that you and I are discussing.
Yeah.
This was not the case a couple of years back. But the Indian stand is still hardened. When we were in Seoul 2 weeks back, we subtly inquired why a big country in the Asia-Pacific region is not present here. And the answer was that they were invited and they declined.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the fact remains that it doesn't help anybody remaining in a state of denial.
Yeah.
We have to accept the facts. Let me give you, General, another information about the melting of the Himalayan glaciers. That is an issue that has to be addressed on an urgent basis. The Himalayan glaciers are one of the world's largest glacier formations, and they are melting at a rate that has not melted at this rate ever in history. Even if you see the visuals from the satellite photography, you see that the tongues are retreating at a much rapid pace. But when that happens, the consequences will be that there'll be flooding and more water coming down in the monsoon periods in the immediate future. And when the glaciers melt even further, then the whole region is going to go dry and there'll be desertification in much of the area. And we are talking about a population of something like 1.5 billion people living in this area, depending on the glaciers. The other danger is that since the water is melting in the glaciers rapidly, so there are something like 750 glacial temporary lakes that has been formed in the hills of the Himalayas. And the biggest danger is these are formed on not very firm ground, but on very loose earth ground. So if we have a glacial lake outburst flooding, GLOF, then we will have tsunami-like flooding of impacts downstream, particularly on countries who are the lower riparian countries, and people could be just swept away without any warning. So the water issues, the glacial lakes issues, all these issues are becoming so complex and they're so interlinked that this cannot be solved by one single country. And unfortunately, many of our political leaders and states don't accept this, but the fact remains that climate change does not accept the very Westphalian concept of state. It does not recognize international boundaries. It has no understanding of the artificial lines we have drawn on the maps for ourselves and are becoming so rigid to it. We have to have international understanding, common international understanding. It is also important for us to say that the fear about securitization of climate change has to go away. When we talk about security impacts of climate change, we certainly don't want to militarize it. We don't want to securitize per se, but we need to securitize certain consequences or certain consequence of the consequences. And these will be very country-specific, very impact-specific, and they have to be considered on a case-to-case basis. When people hear about security impacts of climate change, even when we talked about this in Seoul, there's a lot of fear in people's mind that is the security business getting into climate change and trying to securitize everything? No, it is not. And the security business cannot solve climate change. It is beyond their capacity. But then they have a role to play, particularly because in most cases, in most states, the capacity of the military, the capacity of the defense, capacity of a state has to be plugged in if they want to address the complex issues of climate change. And I would also like to mention here, General, that the military itself has to green themselves. The military is the world's largest polluter. And unless the military is plugged into the system, the military will never understand how much they are polluting and why they need to green themselves before anybody else gives them themselves.
I'm sure you saw the comments from Admiral Locklear, our Pacific Command commander, a couple of weeks back, that's saying that the biggest long-term threat that he sees is climate change. This was our senior guy in the Pacific who said that. And of course, a corollary on this one, it's interesting you brought it up, the number one user of fossil fuels in this country is the Department of Defense. So we've got a big issue here to tackle. But it plays into another question I want to ask you that's perhaps more tactical than strategic. Knowing how fragile your country is and how susceptible it is to climate change, what is your military planning long term in terms of what to do about it? And here in this country, our Pentagon is well known for covering every contingency. I mean, whether it be a hurricane or a nuclear attack, they've got something in the books for just about everything. And our military, I will tell you, just from Admiral Locklear's comments, that they fully recognize the threat of climate change. But in Bangladesh, it's got to be a dominating topic among your military folks as to what to do about it.
In the case of Bangladesh, although Andrew says that Bangladesh recognizes this as an international or a national security issue, unfortunately, we have not addressed it on a comprehensive basis. We haven't given the answers that should be raised when we say that this is a national security issue. The Bangladesh military is very well trained and well prepared to face the consequences of natural disasters, which are very regular to Bangladesh in the form of flooding or cyclones. But when we talk about addressing consequences of climate change, we are talking about a holistic issue, which are far more comprehensive than addressing disasters. My colleague here, the defense attaché from Bangladesh Embassy, will bear me out that we have not been totally given this task of engaging ourselves within the paradigm of impacts of climate change. And that needs to change very, very fast if we really want to prepare ourselves. A military is a very complex machine. You cannot plug in the military without preparation. They have to be trained, they have to be tooled, they have to have the mental acceptance of the mission they're given. Only they can become an effective machine. I'm sure, General, you will agree that the military is a very effective tool provided it has gone through the process of preparation for which they are given a task or a mission. And that, unfortunately, when we work on the index with Andrew, this is an issue we will have to ask in the next phase. It is all right to write down a paper, but what has happened to the paper? How much have you broken it down to specific tasks and missions or preparation? or tooling or retooling, those are issues which have not been addressed. For example, the Bangladesh National Strategy Paper for Climate Change does speak about a 25 million climate refugee, but the sentence ends there. It does not talk about what happens when 25 million people are on the move. Perhaps the state will be under stress. We could also be talking about, in many cases, in South Asia or in Africa and other places, we could be seeing conditions of state collapse, because the stresses that comes from climate change will not come on a sequential basis or not come on a singular basis. We will have multiple stresses coming at one time, at one point. And in conditions of fragility, many of the states will be completely unable to cope with the challenges that come upon them at one point, at one time. We'll have conditions of food security, conditions of refugees, water scarcity, habitation. We'll have conditions of health or pandemics. And many states, however medium-sized or big or small, will be unable to cope with the challenges all coming down at one time. Look at the conditions of health, for example. Health is an issue that will become one of the frontline cases in terms of impacts of climate change, because the nexus of water, habitation, nexus of people on the move, all will have impacts on human health. And when human health deteriorates to a point and the state is unable to provide the medical help and support, we could very easily see conditions when infectious disease could spread out and graduate to a level of pandemics. And for conditions of pandemics, I think most states in the world are completely unprepared to face the conditions of pandemics. I would also like to say here that, for example, in the case of Bangladesh, because we don't have the regular cycles of water anymore, there has been uneven withdrawal of groundwater. The uneven withdrawal of groundwater has also generated a condition when the aquifers have been infected by leaching of the arsenic poison in water. So we are now in a condition when, according to the medical journal Lancet, based in UK, it did a research for about 3 years and came out with the figure that 77 million people in Bangladesh have already been poisoned by arsenic poisoning. And they say that this is the largest mass poisoning of people in the world. The World Health Organization has also warned that now the arsenic water due to irrigation is getting into the agriculture or the food chain. And when that happens, I think the rest 50% will be infected. So we have a wonderful situation when the whole country will go through arsenic poisoning just because of one single fact that the water cycles are not functioning.
You're so encouraging. my God. Andrew, comments on that in the index?
I think that's all right and very true. One of the things that we have noticed in the index is that you go, there's definitely a ranking within countries, some that say things as lip service, but then don't really go beyond that, and then others that are comprehensive planning. But you know, maybe
yes, in fact, I'd like to do. We've got some time left. If you could just raise your hand and let me know, and I won't be too formal today. Just maybe state your name and affiliation, and then if you've got a question or a dialogue. If not, then we'll continue the dialogue up here. But do any of you all have any comments or thing you'd like to add to the conversation? Yes, ma'am. I'll start with you, and then I'll catch you in a second. And yeah, they have to speak kind of loud because we don't have mics out in the audience.
Julia Piper, EAD News, Iowa Wire. You talked about the U.S. on that a little bit more. I was at a conference with Sharon Work earlier today, and they were talking about all the different things that DoD is trying to do to improve their efficiency. Is that the right step? Is that enough? Should the U.S. military be doing more? Could they be more of an international leader? I wonder if you have some more thoughts on the DoD's role, because as you said, it's a major energy user. Some more thoughts on that would be great.
Andrew, you want to take that first?
I'll jump in first. I would say in terms of mitigation of climate change, so reducing emissions, the role of the military in every country is to be able to respond to crises and fight and win the country's wars. It's not to reduce emissions. Now, insofar as increasing efficiency can help with that. That's important insofar as that can save lives, insofar as that can reduce the strategic threats of dependence on fossil fuels. That's all important. The role of the military is not to reduce emissions. That's a role of whole of government, whole of society, really. Military is part of that, but that's not necessarily where they should be leading. And I think Sharon would say the same thing. But in terms of preparations for climate change, U.S. military is leading. Admiral Locklear's comments. It's not just comments either. It's being operationalized. I know the major RIMPAC exercises last summer off Hawaii included disaster response preparation, multinational. The Cobra Gold exercises this past February in Thailand, including 20 regional militaries, included disaster response and relief exercises. So it's about operationalizing this sort of stuff as well.
You bring up the question of the DOD and the energy side associated with climate, and all these issues overlap, and that's part of the reason ASP was created. And you can see the cross between getting off of fossil fuels, which we feel is a huge security problem in this country, our dependence on fossil fuels, particularly that from the Persian Gulf. So if we can get off, well, coal is the huge polluter, but oil in particular, and use alternative energies, then we won't have to depend on Middle East fuel. And have the fifth fleet station in the Persian Gulf at $82 billion a year. I mean, so there's a huge security implication there, but then it dovetails into the climate side of the house, because it's much better to burn biofuels than it is fossil fuels that you've dug out of the ground. So, it's kind of interesting, but the DOD has taken the lead in a lot of this stuff. They're using solar now in the field. They understand that. A lot of the Marines out in Afghanistan on the forward operating bases are using solar power instead of batteries, and they will tell you they'd much rather have that than have to lug the fuel in to run generators. And of course, one of the reasons there is they don't like lugging the fuel in through Pakistan and guarding the convoys. And there's statistics, the number of folks who have died trying to protect the convoys. So it's kind of an overlapping thing, and I think what's encouraging here, Munir, is that our Department of Defense has recognized climate change as a threat. And also the other side of it is they can do a lot on the pollution side of the house. Now there's a lot of pushback on the Hill. And that's part of our job here, is to educate up on the Hill and explain that to both sides and say, here, there's a national security threat because of climate change. Our security is threatened because of our energy dependence on fossil fuels. There are ways to get around this and to help that improve. And have I hit that right, Andrew? Munir, your thoughts on that?
I see that the U.S. military is doing an excellent job in building capacity in different regions of the world, and the exercises that Andrew mentions is a right step in that effort. It also does a lot of stuff on providing alternative fuel capacity for itself. Maybe, Chad, would you like to mention a word of the project that you're doing with the Energy Department?
We finished our contract with the Air Force, but the Air Force Minerva contract is just part of the DoD-wide efforts to do contingency planning for a lot of the more sort of extreme scenarios. So combinations of climate change, energy security, water security, everything bundled together, so that it's not just categorizing climate as one change, but rather how it links into all of the different factors that you've already been mentioning. Navy Task Force Climate Change also works in the same area. Army Environmental Policy Institute. So all the different forces are looking at this in terms of really trying to integrate these sorts of contingencies into the joint planning.
Super.
The only thing that I'm not comfortable with is that the concept of biofuels needs further study, because by solving one problem, we could be creating food security situations in other parts of the world. So the linkage between biofuel as an alternative fuel for U.S. military and the issue of food security has to be really factored in.
No, I wouldn't argue that point. Now, we had someone, yes, ma'am, you had a comment in the back.
Sure. My name is Fahim Mirabal, and I work for the Army Corps of Engineers, working to address some of these issues and building partnership capacity internationally. And I was wondering, General, if you could speak a little bit about, as we try to build resiliency, because I feel like this is probably one of the aspects that we can use to mitigate some of the geostrategic implications of climate change and decreasing risk and security, stability, excuse me. What can you give us any examples of unconventional partnerships that you've seen in your, as you travel internationally speaking about these issues that have been successfully addressing resiliency and capacity building and those related issues?
In terms of resilience, I think the issues have been more local. I didn't see much international partnership in building resilience. In the case of Bangladesh, I think there has been a tremendous growth of resilience which are inbuilt into the people because of the fact that they are constantly facing the consequences of climate change and disasters. But I did not see much international cooperation trying to build on the issue of resilience. And resilience building will be critical if we want to really have a successful adaptation strategy. And in terms of the implementation of adaptation strategy, we are still struggling in most cases, in most countries, not only in Bangladesh, but in other countries too. And as we go along building adaptation strategies, a critical component of the adaptation strategy has to be building the resilience of the people. But in terms of the resilience capacity of Bangladesh, they are pretty high on their own, because people, after a major disaster, spring back to their own feet without any government support in most cases. But the fact remains that in many cases, the degree up to which resilience can go will also be limited. Beyond that, resilience will not work. And that is also the case of Bangladesh.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm Jennifer Mackey, and you mentioned that the issue should not be militarized, but you also discussed that this was something that is their red line issue in Pakistan. Could you discuss that with the moment?
What I'm trying to say is that the problem is so massive that the military cannot solve it. And the military, in no case, will have the lead role to play here. Because this will need a whole of society approach, a whole of government approach, a whole of international communities approach to solve the problem. But on a narrow basis, some of the security concerns of states or bilateral relationship between states go up to a level where this could easily end up in conflict. And in the case of countries which are nuclear armed, the consequences or the grave nature of the consequences are far, far greater. That is the case that we foresee as tensions mount on water issues between India and Pakistan on the issue of the Indus Water Treaty and the pressure that the treaty is in now.
Yeah, you know, I think there was ever a headliner to come out of this conference tonight, that certainly would be one when you talk about it. Possibility of a nuclear confrontation because of water.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, sometimes when you talk about climate and security, I'm reminded of what Trotsky said. You know, you may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you. You know, you may not be interested in climate, but the climate is interested in you. It's going to affect you. So,
Adam Siegel, Insight Through Analysis. General, I'm using the come right after a commentary about nuclear war potential, but basic military adage is to plan for the worst but hope for the best. If one looks at the index or otherwise across virtually every single military, at best it's planning for the best and ignoring the worst. I'll even take in your commentary a version of this. To use the 2007 sea level rise by the IPCC, if you look at where the science is now, that's probably at least by 2050, a half meter, foot to a foot and a half, so 30 to 50 centimeters below where the science would be. It's probably even worse than that. So be using what was very moderate science at that time, and is now about a decade behind where the scientists are right now, the case where the science is right now is far worse than 2007. So how do we get people to be actually thinking about and talking about the worst potential so we can avert it, rather than talking about portraying something as so bad that actually is a scientific best case?
The biggest problem about drawing attention of policymakers to the consequences of climate change is that all our political leaders work on five-year cycles. The visions are cut at 5 years, all to the next elections. Here we are talking about climate migration in the year 2050. And if I talk to my own leaders in our part of the world, the only answer they will have is that it will be somebody else's problem, not mine. But the science that is telling us now, we can see it very clearly that this is going to happen. And the nature is so grave that we cannot prepare on a stage when it happens. We have to have the preparations right now. Much before, we are already behind schedule now. We have to have the preparations in place. And when we have the fifth assessment coming out perhaps this year, I think it is going to come out with more interesting statistics and more interesting predictions. And much of what is going to come out is not going to be something very palatable that we would like to hear. But those are the basic truths. We cannot debate the science of climate change anymore. And the very difficulty that we see on the ground is that the interface between climate science and climate policy is not really happening. What do you think, Andrew? Because some of the science and the modeling is far too complex, far more mathematically complex and mind-boggling for many simple minds like ours or policymakers' minds.
Well, and I think, too, that many policymakers don't think in terms of risk and probability. They think in binary terms. Will this happen or will this not? The military, though, is quite good about doing risk assessments, thinking about, as you say, planning for the worst.
Scenario planning.
Yeah, scenario plannings, looking forward to stuff that Chad does, I've been involved with, is very impressive sort of stuff. And I think that's one of the real roles that the military can play in this, because at least here in the United States, the people over the Pentagon are really the only part of government that has the luxury of thinking for the long term. You know, even now, in the time of budget cuts and everything, they know they're going to have a role in the government for the long term. And they have an institutional reason to plan for the future. So I think that's one of the reasons why military should be involved, because they can plan beyond these 5-year terms.
You know, yours work on a 5-year cycle, ours work on a 2-year cycle. except the Pentagon, and Andrew's right from that perspective, that they do a considerable amount of long-term planning, as you're well aware. And we understand that. It's just the problem, one of the problems I have with it, and it's one of the reasons ASP is here, is anytime you talk climate change, and I'll give you a poignant example that I've raised a number of times that people don't like. We called it the Green Fleet last summer with RIMPAC. And then you mentioned to a lot of other people, say Green Fleet, they think Greenpeace, they think tree hugger, they think left, and it gets so polarized instantaneously that you can't even talk rationally about it. They deny everything. And that still occurs with some regularity. And my recommendation's fallen on deaf ears is to call it America's Fleet, running on fuel, America's fuel, run on America. Get away from the green side of it, although we understand the green side, appreciate it, but please take it out of that context. Don't make it such a polarizing issue. And I see you had a follow-up to it, right, Ed?
Well, I was just going to say, if you want to talk about and use the U.S. military, having been engaged inside, one of the things from the USQDR, where we did talk about climate change, was there's a deliberate choice to take the absolute best assessment from 2007 to put it in the plan because of so many climate deniers in the process. So they actually took the absolute best case of 2007 as part of the analysis for the Quadrennial Defense
Review. To appease,
to avoid being criticized, so that assessment.
Or maybe to reduce the shock.
Across the board, was a very, very low level assessment of climate risks that led into the QDR discussions 3 years ago.
At least it got in there.
It got in there, yes.
Yeah,
I mean.
No, I'm just saying, even with achieving that, it was a very interesting what the military people involved chose to do.
Sure. But I think what the QDR did was filtered out some of the more unabsorbable shocks and tone it down to a level when people could cope with it. But when we did the scenario planning exercise with Tracy and Chad, some of the scenarios don't look very well. Am I right, Tracy? They don't look at all well.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Hi. Russell Stickler from the Stimson Center. Given that climate change in South Asia is transboundary in nature, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the role of regional organizations, like the this out, the Asian Association for Regional Cooperation. To what extent has SAARC maybe recognized climate change as a regional security issue, and do they have the capacity at all to help address some of these challenges?
A very short answer, no.
Well,
the SAARC has given some lip service to climate change, but in terms of practical implementation of anything tangible, nothing, zero, absolutely zero. And also the problem is that the, given the very complex relationship of animosity within the region, where issues between India and Pakistan dominate much of the relations within the region, not much regional cooperation has been possible on a regional basis. But the dire need is that it has to be addressed on a regional basis, because many of the consequences are not only bilateral, but they are completely multilateral. But again, coming back to the problem is that, as Andrew said, that India does not see climate as a security issue. India does not believe in any multilateral discussions on any issues of environment in the region. If you have a problem with India, all that they'll say, come and talk to me on a bilateral basis. But now, the only change I've heard I see is that now that they're fearing that the Chinese are going to withdraw water, so they're coming back to the smaller countries and saying that we should have a coalition together to talk to the Chinese. So there's a little bit of change I've heard, but on a very narrow basis.
Well, there's an answer. I think we can take one more. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is John Lewis, Terra Global Capital. But for 25 years, I was at USAID, and I'm struck at the way these policy issues are approached and the frameworks and the assumptions and the difficulty of getting countries to talk to each other in South Asia, but just the difficulty for, you know, the taxpayer investing small amount of monies and learning why deforestation in Nepal hurts Bangladesh, and so much of the policy establishment on the other side of the Potomac not really making use of that knowledge and vice versa. We got a forest code reform going in Niger and Burkina Faso, which made them much greener. Mali did not participate because it was still 20 years ago a Soviet client state. The result is the what's called assisted natural regeneration didn't happen in Mali, and therefore the Tuareg became much more open to other kinds of contacts. And boom, we have a war in Mali, and we don't have one in Niger or Burkina Faso to the same extent. And really, if there had been some discussion across the Potomac River, there would have been perhaps a more mature approach 3 or 4 years ago to Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. You know, going to South Asia, we have this deforestation problem up in the Himalayas, which is hurting Bangladesh. These things are known, but never, in my experience, has the question of land reform been put on the table. People aren't going to plant and protect trees unless they have some sense that their children are going to enjoy those trees. And that was just never on the table. The UN refuses, basically, as an institution internationally, to get into that, except for powerless conventions like the Desertification Convention. But I was on the US Climate Change Kyoto delegation, and we just couldn't get it in there because it wasn't discussable. Whereas if the military policy dialogue says, well, wait a minute, land tenure is a security risk, because without land tenure, you get deforestation. Land tenure security, you get deforestation, and therefore you get this kind of erosion and runoff, and you can't manage the water, and there's no water storage in the upper mountain areas. Let's get it on the agenda. Then it would have been on the agenda. But this didn't happen. And
the example you use, and we've used it here, not quite that slant to it on the Tuaregs in Mali, you know, because climate change is what drove part of their migration, and then that was a great contributor to what happened in Mali. And of course, it's
with Soviet land tenure policies.
You betcha. And I didn't quite pull the string that far, but
yeah,
Andrew, here.
No, what you say is exactly is the bigger picture, but the problem is that we are unable to connect the dots. For the people at the policy level, we are not connecting the dots and seeing how these impact on each other. And unless we do that, we will not get the bigger picture together. One of the issues before we end here, I wanted to mention is that why we are all in it together. Like, for example, in the United States, much of your coastal region is as vulnerable as Bangladesh is, where we may be with two other parts, the corners of the world, but our coastal vulnerability is as grave as anybody else's. We tried to do a small study on seeing the vulnerability of cities that have mega impacts on the international financial system. And would you believe places like New York, London, Shanghai, they could all be flooded and it could shut down its all the banking system, the stock exchange and everything, and that will completely send out shockwaves in the international financial system if it is shut down for a week. We have never considered that we are all in it together in the same boat, whether we are rich, poor, black, white, we are all in it together. This is a very critical message that has to sink home.
Well, I can't think of a better comment, not necessarily optimistic, but we are in it all together, Mayor. And I'm so pleased that you were able to come by. It was just, I guess, a coincidence that you both were together in Seoul, but having you come through here just lends a whole different perspective, I think, to the security perspective here in this country, and certainly what's going on in your country, just, it's hair-raising, in my opinion. I am so glad you gave me your perspective. Andrew, thanks for your work. If we could all give him a big round of applause. Well, we've been, that's our hash code there, and we've been tweeting this during the whole time. It'll be up on our website tonight if anybody wants to come back to it. Hit our website for future events. We've got several coming up, so again, I thank you all for being here.